Luke 20:37-21:4, the 82nd talk in a series entitled The Gospel of Luke, was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 9, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're looking at a scary section this morning, so let's pray. Father, we live in very unsettled times, and we're reminded of what the prophets told Israel often, that there isn't anything that can't be shaken. Lord, even the foundations of the earth will one day be shaken. So, Lord, we ask that you would turn our hearts to you, who are our rock. You are the only one who is stable and steady and permanent and eternal, the only one who can give our existence life and meaning. Lord, put that in our heart. Just drive it deep into our being, that might be our anchor and our hope for all of eternity. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, there were a couple of questions that came up after last week. Because I don't think I was as clear as I really needed to be. So I'd like to back up just briefly before we press on in the text to a passage that we looked at last week. It would be 20:41-44. Now, once he said to them, in what sense do they mean it when they say that the Christ is... No, sorry, that's not it. Go back up to 20:34, where he's proving the resurrection from the Old Testament account. But that the dead are raised, Moses, in fact, discloses at the bush, since it states, the Lord, the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now, he is not God in relation to those who are dead, but in relation to those who are living. So these men all live to him. The argument is rather subtle, I think. So rather than try to ad lib on this, let me read. It's a three-page thing here that I wrote out to try to give me time to collect my thoughts and be as clear as I could. So let me try to go over that again, but I'm going to do so by reading, if you'll forgive me. I'm going to start with a paraphrase of Jesus' response to the Sadducees and then an explanation following that. So here's the paraphrase. Even Moses showed that the dead are raised. It shows us that, in fact, in his account of his encounter with God in the burning bush on Mount Sinai. More than once, Yahweh refers to himself as Yahweh, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Think about it. Do you understand what that means? Yahweh is saying that he intends to act in his role and capacity as the God of Abraham. How can he act in his capacity as the God of Abraham if Abraham is dead and forever gone? Yahweh is saying that he intends to act in his role and capacity as the God of Isaac. How can he act in his capacity as the God of Isaac if Isaac is dead and forever gone? Yahweh is saying that he intends to act in his role and capacity as the God of Jacob. How can he act in his capacity as the God of Jacob if Jacob is dead and forever gone? Yahweh is not declaring his intention to act as God in relation to men who are dead. He is declaring his intention to act as God in relation to men who have life and existence. From the standpoint of God's purposes, all these men are very much alive in relation to God. So some comments on explaining his answer here. In order to understand the force of Jesus' answer, a number of things need to be understood. First, we need to understand what Yahweh is saying to Moses at the bush. Fundamentally, Yahweh is telling Moses that his intention is to now proceed to fulfill the promises he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And for that, you could look at Exodus 6:1-9, where I think that becomes clear. He intends to give the land that he promised to Israel. He intends to establish a relationship with Israel wherein they are his people and he is their God. Secondly, God's self-identification as Yahweh, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, does not mean, I am Yahweh, the very same God that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob used to worship and serve when they were alive. The language could be construed that way, certainly. But that is not what Yahweh means. No, rather it means, I am Yahweh, the God who made a promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that up to this point I have never fulfilled. I stand here ready to fulfill those still unfulfilled promises that I made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So here I am now, revealing myself to you, to Moses, and asking you to play a role in what I am about to do. I am asking you to play a role in my fulfilling those promises. Thirdly, we need to understand what Jesus understands by the concept of the God of Abraham. I will use Abraham as a variable that could also mean Isaac or Jacob. Specifically, what would it mean for God to function in the role or capacity as the God of Abraham? To be a God, or more specifically, to be the God, is to be the one with power and authority to shape history and reality in order to conform it to his will. To be the God of Abraham, in specific, is to have the power and authority to shape history and reality to be to the benefit of Abraham. Remember, God revealed himself to Abraham and promised that he would grant him a blessing. To be Abraham's God, that is to function as the God of Abraham, is to be the one who, out of his power as God, directed reality in such a way that Abraham gets blessed. What is this blessing that God promised to Abraham? It is multifaceted, but the aspect of his promise that is in view at the burning bush is this, that God would make Abraham a great nation of people who would serve Yahweh as their God and over whom God would function as their God. This part of God's promise to Abraham was never fulfilled before Abraham's death. Indeed, none of what God promised to Abraham was fulfilled. Accordingly, at Abraham's death, Yahweh had never yet been Abraham's God. That is, God had not yet shaped history and reality to the benefit of Abraham in the specific way that he had promised. Yahweh will be, and Yahweh will establish himself as the God of Abraham when and only when, he shapes history and reality to fulfill the promises he made to him. Until such time as he does this, God has never functioned as the God of Abraham. He's made promises, but he has never vindicated himself as Abraham's God, for he has never functioned in that capacity. That then brings us to the crucial issue. Can Yahweh be the God of Abraham after Abraham is dead? Jesus reasons, no, he cannot. Once Abraham is dead, it would be impossible for Yahweh to be Abraham's God. We need to understand Jesus' reasoning here. Very simply, to be the God of Abraham means to be the one who effectively shapes history and reality to the benefit of Abraham, to the end that Abraham receives a blessing. It follows then that he can be the God of Abraham only while Abraham is alive, aware, conscious, and existing. To accomplish something in history that Abraham would actually experience as a positive blessing can only be accomplished if and while Abraham is alive, that is, if and while Abraham is in a position to experience it as a blessing. If Yahweh were to actually bring to pass that which he said he was going to bring to pass as a blessing for Abraham, after Abraham is dead, gone, and no longer in a position to be blessed by it, then Yahweh has not successfully functioned as God to Abraham. He has not been in any meaningful sense Abraham's benefactor. He's not given positive shape, meaning, and significance to Abraham's existence, for Abraham would no longer have existence to give meaning and significance to. Accordingly, if Abraham ceases to exist, then the possibility of being the God of Abraham ceases with him, if God has not already successfully and meaningfully functioned in that role. 5. So we are finally in a position to understand Jesus' answer to the Sadducees. If at the bush on Sinai, Yahweh declares himself to Moses as Yahweh, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, thereby suggesting that his purpose is to now begin to give substance to the blessing that he promised to those men, then it necessarily follows that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob must now have, or at the very least will sometime again have, existence as conscious, aware beings. For given the reasons explained above, Yahweh cannot function as the God of these men if their existence has ceased once and for all. Yahweh cannot grant a blessing to men who do not exist. Yahweh cannot shape history to the advantage of men who are not there to enjoy that advantage. How can what God accomplishes be an advantage or benefit to them if they do not exist? There's something very important to note about Jesus' reasoning here. Jesus' reasoning is totally dependent upon three things. One, the fact that Yahweh has made promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that he has not yet fulfilled at the time Yahweh appears to Moses. Two, the fact that Yahweh's express intent at the encounter with Moses is to fulfill those very same unfulfilled promises. And three, the fact that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have died at the time of the encounter. If any one of these three facts were not in place, then Jesus' argument would lose its force. If God had said, "I am the God of Ichabod," and God had never made any promises to Ichabod, then Yahweh's assertion would prove nothing with respect to the resurrection of the dead. If God had reference merely to a dead Ichabod, one would naturally take God's assertion to mean, "I am the one whom Ichabod looked to as his God when Ichabod was alive." Further, if Ichabod were alive when the same statement was made, then of course the statement proves nothing with respect to what will be the case after Ichabod dies. Still further, if Yahweh had made promises to Ichabod, but he had no intention to fulfill them, and in fact never did fulfill them, then again the statement proves nothing. For again, the significance of the statement would be nothing more than that when Ichabod lived, I was counted as his God. I failed him in that capacity. I wasn't a very good or successful God, but that's how Ichabod viewed me. Therefore, it should be clear how vitally important are the specific historical circumstances within which the statement at the burning bush is uttered. It is not the statement in isolation that Jesus believes proves that the dead are raised. It is the statement in its specific historical circumstances and in the context of its specific historical intent that proves that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are or will be raised from the dead. Jesus does not believe that he has proved that men in general are raised from the dead. He believes he has proved that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are raised from the dead. But this is an important refutation of the viewpoint of the Sadducees, for the Sadducees hold the perspective that there is no resurrection on the grounds that such a thing is not possible. But as Jesus shows by his argument, if it is a requirement that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob be raised from the dead, then apparently it is in fact possible after all. Let me just open it up to your questions, and while you're thinking of whether you have any questions, the other issue that came up was I suggesting that Abraham died without having any hope that the promises would be fulfilled? And that was not what I was suggesting at all. It's very clear that the New Testament writers understand Abraham to have died still believing in this God who had made promises to him and in the fulfillment of those promises. In fact, in Hebrews 11, it makes a big deal out of that. So nothing I said last week or this week should be construed as in any way suggesting that Abraham didn't have faith or didn't have good grounds for his faith. Quite to the contrary, he had very good grounds for his faith, and his faith persevered and he maintained. When I talk about God not having functioned as God, what I mean by that is God had not done yet what he had promised he would do for Abraham. And that's at the crux of Jesus' argument, because if he hadn't done yet what he had promised to Abraham, it doesn't do any good to Abraham for God to do it after Abraham is dead, if he doesn't exist. And so that it's on that basis that Jesus is arguing he must exist. Otherwise, why is God so intent on keeping the promises he made to him? Why is that even relevant if he doesn't exist? Any questions on that before we press on?
I've got one, Jack. Forgive me, I wasn't here last week. But in the way that God says that, calls Jacob Israel and refers to Jacob and Israel as the nation of Israel, mm-hmm. would he make reference to Abraham in the same way, and that he is the God of Abraham, he is the God of Israel, of this people, and not just of this single man?
He would, but that's the ambiguity in a phrase like that. Are you talking about the individual, or are you talking about the people group that comes from him? I think clearly in this context, he's understanding it as the individuals. The whole argument depends on that.
So. Okay, I wasn't here and haven't read that recently, so I wasn't sure, but obviously the nation of Israel is still alive.
So. Right.
Okay, thanks.
Jack, did I hear you correctly? You said that the promise wouldn't be any good to Abraham unless he existed or would exist again.
Right.
Okay, could you just from your perspective, could be either one of those
yes.
two?
Yes. Yeah, I don't think the text establishes one way or the other whether Abraham is alive right now or whether he will be
alive
existing
again
in the resurrection.
Later in time.
Yeah.
It's sort of like he's on a nap timeout.
Yes.
A timeout nap.
Yes.
Okay.
Because the question is whether or not there is a resurrection of the dead. So, I mean, if the text is suggesting anything, it's more likely that, yeah, he's on a timeout and he will one day be raised again. But I don't think we can know. I don't think we can know that.
Just to play the Sadducees advocate here. So from my point of view, if God told me you'll have lots of descendants and they'll do really great things, and if I 100% believed God that was going to happen, to me that would be enough of a blessing. Like if I really believed God, I wouldn't necessarily need to see it come to fruition. So when I've heard about the promises to Abraham and everything, I've just thought, well, yeah, that was a blessing for Abraham to know that he'd have all these descendants. So maybe you can go into why Abraham would need to see it for it to be a blessing if he had believed God.
Well, what if God had never fulfilled them?
Yeah.
What would, you know, that then what I did is yes, it gave a certain kind of meaning to my life and purpose for my life and a certain kind of delight and joy in something. I mean, there was a blessing there, that's true. But in the end, it was all a lie. You know, it was all wishful thinking. It was a fairy tale. It was a fiction,
right,
which is what everybody thinks we Christians believe.
Right. Okay.
So, it could have that effect, you know, but what a sham then. So in order for God to vindicate this promise that he's made to God as not just some fairy tale to help him cope with, you know, a dark existence, that it was actually objective truth and objective reality, Abraham needs to see that in order for that to be vindicated as such in his eyes. Because if he doesn't see it, what's the good of it to him? You know, what's the point to him?
Okay.
And furthermore, I mentioned that the blessings are multifaceted. Some of those elements of that blessing, it's basically comes down to eternal life. If that's not actual, then Abraham gets nothing.
Thanks.
About the burning bush thing a little bit. And I'm wondering if part of Jesus' argument is about God's interaction with Moses. And if I were Moses and I'm looking at a burning bush, I mean, it seems like God's saying, listen, there are two realities. And if you interact with this fire in your reality, you will be consumed. You'll be burned by this fire. I'm in the fire, and I'm not being affected by it. It doesn't hurt me. And in fact, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are in the fire with me also, and they are not being consumed or affected by it. So there are, in essence, the burning bush itself argues that there is eternal life. There is another existence beyond this existence where the things in this world that hurt us don't hurt us there. And then I think about, you know, later Moses said, gee, I just want to see you, God. And God goes, well, okay, I'll put you between these two rocks and I'll kind of pass by and you might be able to see like my hindquarters or something like that, right? Because to see God is to die. And so it's like the bridge between our reality and eternal life is death. And it seems like that when God uses a metaphor to illustrate himself to us, like a burning bush or a large wind, there are always things that kill us. And it's like, okay, you can interact with me here on earth if you want, but if you do, you'll die, then you have to be in the other. Does that make sense? I'm not trying to be spooky, but
yeah.
You see what I'm trying to say?
So you're trying to unpack the actual visual metaphor of the burning bush is what you...
Yes.
Yeah, that's as good as any. I mean, I don't. I really,
I feel so much better.
I'm just not sure that I know. I mean, fire could be a symbol of so many things. Destruction on the one hand, purification on the other hand, light on the other hand. I mean, I'm just not sure. So what you propose is as plausible as anything that I could come up with. You did say something, though, that I'm not sure would be there in the text, and I think we'd be reading into it, and that would be that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are there with him. I don't think we have any indication of that, unless you.
I'm the God of these guys. I'm the God of these guys.
Yeah.
Which, as you have implied, means that they're alive.
Right.
Well, they're obviously not alive in Moses' reality.
Oh, okay.
So they must
saying.
Be alive in God's reality.
Yeah.
And they must have a different sort of existence because the fire is not hurting Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob either, because they're alive with God on that side.
Yeah. And so I guess the only thing I'm saying is that the leap there would be, if they're in a different order of existence, why would I even think they could possibly be vulnerable to the fire? I mean, what? Maybe they're someplace else. So I'm not sure how much that would prove, because I don't know enough to know that I could reason from the fact that they're in the fire. So that's the only objection I would raise to that.
Do you know much about the Sadducees and their religious views? I mean, what are they all about? I mean, as far as, is there any kind of future hope for them? Is there a reincarnation? Is there anything beyond this existence? Or is their religious nature just surely about this world and that's it?
Best I understand it, it's just purely about this world and that's it.
Do you know if is it a religion based on morality, at least? Or is it like prosperity gospel, power?
Undoubtedly, it would have to incorporate things of morality, because their authority were the first five books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch. And to the extent that there's moral laws in there, how they couldn't ignore those. But then the Pharisees are all about reality and they're immoral people. I think you'd find the same thing among the Sadducees. They speak the morality game when necessary, but they're utterly immoral people.
Well, at least the Pharisees had an outward appearance of morality. I mean, I picture the Sadducees as being about exotic robes and lifestyles that are pretty highfalutin and aristocratic and all that.
Yeah, I think you basically find what we in fundamentalistic or conservative Christian culture value was divided between those two groups. The Pharisees were into personal piety. The Sadducees were very much into institutional religion and liturgy. So the Sadducees were the high church Jews, and the Pharisees were a low church Jew. They hung out in the synagogues. The Sadducees centered their whole life around the temple and the ritual of the temple. So in both of those cases, you know, Paul's word to Timothy, they hold on to the form of religion, but they deny the power of it. That's basically fundamentally what we have, is that these are hollow shells of God worshippers. They're God worshippers on the outside according to their own particular cultural tradition. They're God worshippers on the outside, but there's nothing inside. There's no inwardness. There's no inner orientation of a heart given over to God.
So their view basically is just God gives you these 60, 80 years and that's your toast after that.
Seems to be, So, you know, if you lose your position and your place from Rome, I mean, that's it. that was your only chance. So you can see the desperation of these men. Yeah, this dude's got to die. This guy is really threatening our whole existence. Everything that is to us, this guy could destroy, this guy Jesus. He's got to die. So, yeah, I mean, once you understand their worldview, it helps to understand why they are so intent on the destruction of Jesus. Okay, one more, then we'll move on.
Just a quick comment. That also strikes me as being the worldview of most of secular America, too.
Yeah.
I mean, and you could probably throw in a good measure of, you know, so-called religious America along with that, is that, you know, they're happy if their children are prosperous and, you know, seem well off, and if they've left a good name for themselves on earth. That seems to be the extent of fulfillment that most people are hoping for.
Yeah, exactly. That's huge. We are constantly losing sight of the fact that what we confess as part of our faith is, we lose sight of the fact that it's actually true. And that what we're confessing as our faith is that we're not made for this world. We don't have to get it now. This doesn't have to be the place where we are happy and blessed. That we were made for another existence, a whole other order of existence. And that will come. And just like Abraham is looking at a promise made to him that he's not seen the fulfillment of, we are in the position of looking forward to a promise made to us that right now we haven't seen fulfilled. And the question is, but do I believe it's true enough that I'm going to stake my life on it, stake my existence on it? And I think David is right. I mean, not only the secular America, but most of religious America has its hope in this world, in getting it now. And what good is Jesus? He gives it to you now. Come to Jesus and he'll make you happy. And it's just not true. He's really inconvenient. He really gets in the way. Okay, let's go on. So we are at 20:45. And once, when all the people could hear, he said to the disciples, "Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and who love respectful greetings in the marketplaces and chief seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets. These men devour widows' houses, and then, to give a false impression, they offer up long prayers. These will receive a more demanding judgment." Okay, this is just a what we have starting here in 3:19, I think, is just a series of things that happened sometime during his teaching these last 3 days before his crucifixion. We don't know when. They're not situated in time. We don't know in connection with what other events. I think he's just giving, giving us these three snapshots. And this is one of the snapshots. He was speaking to the disciples, but it was in the earshot of everybody who was gathered there. Beware of the scribes. Okay, why beware? Because Jesus understands how seductive their values are. Remember earlier in the gospel where he talked about beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, because it is, which is hypocrisy. That is the kind of play acting that we engage in religious circles. The better the play actor we are, the more real we can make it seem. If I act out my script competently, I can make you believe through my actions that this is real spirituality, that I'm really relating to God, that I'm really oriented toward God, that I have some kind of connection with God. And I can intimidate you to no end by my performance if I'm competent, if I'm really good at it. And the problem with that is we get intimidated into conforming to it. Well, I don't want to look like a pagan. I mean, I don't want to look like I don't have faith. I don't want to look like I'm immoral, like I'm a sinner or nothing. And so I begin to make the same movements of the dance that you're making so that you might think I'm a dancer. In order that you would think I'm one of you. And Jesus understands that dynamic very, very well. And so he realizes that we have to be on our guard. We have to beware. Don't be seduced or intimidated into becoming one of them, into wanting what they want, giving priority to what they give priority to their set of values. Don't buy it at all. Be independent enough, be courageously independent enough that you're willing to actually work on your orientation to God and God alone without regard to what how other people evaluate it or look at it or how they think about it. There really is no other kind of discipleship. You cannot be disciples of Jesus in a herd. Only individuals can do business with their God in the authentic, appropriate, inward kind of way that counts. Going together as a flock and obeying Jesus or following Jesus is not following Jesus at all. And Jesus understands that as well as anybody, better than anybody, obviously. So he starts this, beware of the scribes. What the impact they're going to have on your life is going to be very difficult to fend off. So be on your guard, beware. Long robes, they apparently had a practice of wearing a very distinctive kind of robe that basically was a uniform so that you knew that they were a scribe, a rabbi. Maybe I've never defined scribe. I don't remember if I have. A scribe is not, it's kind of counterintuitive because the word means somebody who copies things, right, is a scribe. So if you're making a copy of the text of the Old Testament or something, you're the one who's copying it and replicating the scriptures. That's where the name comes from, but what the word means is the way it's used here in the gospel is that was the practice of those people who were students of the law. They would copy the law. But what we today would call a rabbi is a scribe. A scribe is someone who's a student of the law, is an expert in the law, has taught themselves the law and learned it, and is in a position to tell other people. Now, because we're dealing with primarily Pharisees, the Pharisees were as much, if not more, learned in the tradition of the other rabbis as they were in what we would consider to be the scriptures themselves. So it's well worth kind of getting a feel for the rabbinic tradition, because the rabbinic tradition today is the ancestor? Is that what I mean? Going this direction? Descendant. There we go. Is the descendant. Rabbinic Judaism today is the descendant of exactly these scribes here in the pages of the New Testament. So if you get a feel for that, you get a kind of a sense of what Jesus is up against here. They don't actually teach the scriptures. They teach what the tradition, a constantly ever-changing, dynamic tradition, is teaching you to think about the scriptures. But in any case, they are experts in their own mind, in their own self-definition. They are experts in the law. So they have long robes, apparently, at this time, that are their uniform, so that they are just obvious in public. Just like a military uniform would make it clear that someone is in the armed services, seeing one of these guys in their long robe would make it clear that they are a scribe, an expert in the law. And he says they love their long robes, their respectful greetings. Because they're obvious, you know that they're a scribe, so you have all kinds of deference that you pay to them in public. There's various titles that you would use. Rabbi itself means great one, or something like that. it's the root word is great, that you are great. You are a great one. There's all kinds of different greetings that people would give to them, all of which are showing deference and respect for them. At the synagogue, there was a bench right in front of the place where the scroll, the Torah, would have been, that were the chief seats at the synagogue, that you sit on this bench and you're facing the other worshipers, the congregants. And the chief seats at the synagogue belong to the scribes. The scribes get to sit there. And there is some pecking order, some priority, seniority of rabbis. So that's what you really wanted in life. Your ambition would have been to be one who can sit at that chief seat. Or at meals, at every meal, there was always one of the places around the table that was designated as the place of honor. That would be given to scribes over other people. 'Cause all this they love. And yet, Jesus says, they devour widows' houses. Okay, what is he talking about? By custom, rabbis were not allowed to charge a fee for their teaching. If any of you know anything about Greek history, the sophists in the time of Socrates charged to teach people. They charged a fee. Socrates was distinctive in that he refused to charge a fee. There's that same tradition in rabbinic Judaism. Rabbis do not, in fact, it would have seemed blasphemous and irreligious and immoral to charge a fee for their teaching. But although they don't charge a fee for their teaching, they accept charity, if you will, or they accept support, financial support from people. And if you've ever, every now and then you run into a missionary or a preacher or a pastor that fits these guys to the T, because by virtue of their position, they virtually demand that you be generous to them. Show them hospitality, give them stuff. It's almost like you owe it to them by virtue of they've given their life to God. You know, they're serving God, and because they're serving God, the least you can do is give your material resources to them. It's a mindset, and it's a really ugly mindset. That seems to be what had taken over the culture of the scribes at this time, is that they don't think anything of going into a widow's house who will take everything that she has, all the provisions that she has to feed them, and they think they deserve it. I think that's what he means by devouring widows' houses. Your pretense, your presumption, you are so arrogant about the role that you're playing that you will allow people to exhaust their resources showing respect for you, and you'll walk away and let them, you know, and let them sit in their poverty. And he's saying that stinks. That is utterly reprehensible that you would have that kind of perspective on yourself. And then he says, but then you cover up what is fundamentally morally ugly and despicable, your willingness to basically rob other people by virtue of the coercive nature of your presumption. You'll hide that immorality with your long prayers. You do this really, really fine religious thing that makes it all seem right because you're such a godly and righteous person. And Jesus ends that by saying, you will receive a more demanding judgment. And I think the point that he's making, I don't think it's any more complicated than you study the law. You know what? There in the law, you have all the information you need to know better than that. It would be one thing if you were ignorant. It would be one thing if you just didn't know what God required. It would be one thing if you were just so clueless that you had no basis to measure your own actions by. But you do. You're experts in the law. You know good and well that God does not approve of the kind of attitude and presumption that characterizes your lives. So there's going to be a more demanding judgment on you because you should know better. Okay, that's that snapshot. Then he goes on. Now once, when he looked up, he saw the rich putting their gifts into the temple treasury. But he also saw a poor widow putting two lepta. Those are just tiny, small copper coins, virtually worthless, you know, that of no real objective value to speak of. But he saw a poor widow putting two lepta in it. So he said, I tell you the truth. The poor widow put in more than all of them, for they all put into their gifts out of what was surplus for them, but she, out of her poverty, put in all that she had to live on. Don't think there's anything complicated about understanding this section. The temple treasury, doing all this institutional ritual and religion and liturgy that was done in the temple was expensive. You burned a lot of wood, you killed a lot of animals, you made a lot of incense. Incense was not necessarily cheap. There's a lot of expenses in just doing the day-in, day-out routine of the ritual of the temple. So they needed money. And the way they financed it was through voluntary offerings that people would give And in fact, apparently, you could actually designate where your offering would go for the wood of the altar, for incense, you know, whatever, and different containers would be for different purposes. They had, according to the Mishnah, they had trumpet-shaped kind of containers in the outer, the court of women, it was called, where women and men were able to go into that part of the temple. And so in all the surrounds of that court, there were these various trumpet-like offering containers. That's probably what this woman is doing, is putting her two lepta into one of these offering containers. I don't know what to call it. But that will go directly into the temple treasury to defray the cost of temple worship. Well, rich people, all kinds of people are coming in and giving their offerings in this temple. Jesus is watching all this, and he sees this one very poor widow come in and put her two lepta in it. And then he just comments on it. And he says, she put in more than all of them. The first important question, I think, to ask about this is how are we to understand this act of the poor widow? And how is Jesus looking at the act of the poor widow? Is it responsible or is it irresponsible? Is it foolhardy or is it not foolhardy? I don't think Jesus is telling us, one way or the other, what he thinks about the economic wisdom of this offering that the widow made. I think all of our rationality tells us that it was foolhardy and irresponsible. And I just have to assume that would be Jesus' perspective on it as well, that it was actually foolhardy and irresponsible of her. What's remarkable is that Jesus doesn't condemn her for that reason. Yes, it's foolhardy, it's irresponsible, it's everything you got, lady. You got to eat, and you're giving up everything that you got. That's crazy. But what he finds is what's admirable about it, not what's crazy about it. He commends her for it because of what it represents about her inner orientation toward God. Why is she doing what she's doing? Because she takes God seriously. Why is she doing it? Because she loves God. Why is she doing it? She wants to show her regard and her respect for God. Why is she doing it? Her life is committed to serving God. And Jesus is looking at the motive, the inwardness, the inner orientation that is motivating the action, and that's what he's looking at and that's what he's commending. What she is doing is far more significant than what these rich people are doing. If our inner orientation to God is right, it matters relatively little that our expression of that in our actions is clumsy, inept, irrational, and even wrong. It's not about results in the end. It's not about what effect we have in the world in the end. That's of relatively little consequence to God, relatively little consequence to Jesus. What Jesus looks at and what screams out the loudest to him, however foolhardy and irresponsible this lady might be, what screams at him is, there's someone who really takes God seriously. But it's not noble and good because it is irrational and wrong. It's noble and good in spite of the fact that it's irrational and wrong for her to do what she did. But it's nonetheless noble and good. So let me make three observations about this account. The first one is the gifts of the rich accomplished dramatically more for the temple than the gift of the widow. In terms of defraying costs and allowing the functioning of the temple to go on, it was the gifts of the rich that were significant, not the gifts of the widow, if that's our measure. Indeed, her gift shrinks to utter insignificance by comparison. But Jesus thinks that the widow's gift has much greater significance. This can only be true because what is important to God is not what you accomplish in the service of God. The widow accomplished insignificantly little. What is important is what one's service or one's contribution represents with regard to one's orientation toward God. That's what matters. That is, its importance lies in what it represents in terms of one's love for God, one's gratitude toward God, one's desire to serve God, one's desire to obey God, and so on. That's where the importance of an action lies, not in what it gets done objectively out there in the world. The second thing that I think is noteworthy about this is that I don't think it's any accident that Luke locates this immediately preceding a passage where Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple. That's what we're going to get into in the next section. He predicts that the temple is going to be torn apart and there won't even be one stone left upon another. Well, he locates this immediately before that, and I think he had a choice about where he would put it because it's not connected in the chronology of the account. So I don't think it's an accident. I think Luke intends us to see a very ironic contrast. The gifts given to the temple are being used to build a structure that is shortly to be utterly destroyed. This fact helps accentuate the fact that the practically, objectively greater contributions of the rich as compared to the widow is not really significant in the end. As we often say to one another, in the end, with respect to the stuff we're worried about and that we're working on, that we're striving for, in the end, it's going to burn. And that's true. I mean, here is a concrete example in history. All this energy, all this thought, all this money going in to build this temple, 40 years after this, is going to be nothing but rubble on the ground. So what did the rich accomplish objectively, really? Well, given the temporality of this world, given how fragile this world is, not really anything. At first glance, it might look like they have accomplished a great deal, but not in the scope of history and certainly not in the scope of eternity. So again, the value of one's offering or service to God is not its concrete or historical effects. Rather, it is only in the inward orientation that such service offered to God, what that service represents. That's what's eternal. That's what is always significant and remains significant. The objectively valuable contribution of the rich is going to be nullified by the end of the temple, but the objectively insignificant contribution of the widow will never and can never be nullified by anything. And although it is objectively insignificant, subjectively it is highly significant what she did, as Jesus puts it, more significant than any of them. And then third point, not only did he locate it before the prediction of the destruction of the temple, but he located it after his telling them to beware of the scribes who have these values where they plaster on piety on the outside and are more than happy to receive all of the acclaim that comes to them before that. Luke locates this immediately following Jesus' assessment of the scribes. This is not an accident, I think. I think Luke intends us to see an ironic contrast here. The scribes' alleged service of God, their piety and their righteousness, clearly pays off for them. They enjoy a significant social and economic reward for their service of God. Honor, glory, acknowledgement, recognition, social power, economic comfort, the rewards are endless for them. Doesn't really cost them to serve God. It pays off to them to serve God. But by contrast, look at this widow. The dramatically self-sacrificial act of the widow has no such payoff. It costs her everything, and it gave her nothing. She doesn't do it to be seen and praised, as the scribes do. There really isn't anything to see. I mean, if anyone saw how much she gave, would they applaud her or would they laugh? Two lepta? She only gave an insignificant amount. The widow does it for one and only one reason, then. She does it to express her inner desire to serve God, not in order to be praised and acknowledged by other people. So the contrast there is really stark. Well, boy, we don't have that much time, so I'll take your comments or questions, and we'll get into the scary stuff next week, the end of the world stuff.
Thank you, Jack. That was really good. I had a couple of questions, sort of picking up on the offering theme, if you will. One is more of a, I guess they're both kind of historical questions, but the second one might be somewhat theological as well. The first one is, if you happen to know, just off the top of your head, one of the things that I, over the years, have tended to become more and more bothered by, personally, in church culture in general, is the practice of the offering plate that gets passed around from row to row and everything. Mostly because it always seemed to me as kind of, the motivation was to compel people to put more into the plate because everyone could see what, how much was going into the plate and who was giving more and who was giving less. So, you know, the idea of, better to have less money and have it come from people who really want to give than to have more money because we've somehow shamed people into giving more. It always seemed like that wasn't really a value. So, I guess one thing was, if you happen to know just as a student of church history where that arisen from, because it sounds like the way you're describing it is they had these specific places set up and then someone goes and puts something in and maybe somebody sees you do it and maybe somebody doesn't. That's not even really, an issue. So I guess that's my first question. And my second question is about tithing. I mean, how does that fit into, is that still a priority at this point in history for Jewish culture and all that? And I don't know, what do you do with that? So,
mm-hmm. Let me deal with the last one first. As far as I know, it is. I've never read anything specifically about that, and certainly nothing that would say that it wasn't. And I can't imagine that it's not. I mean, given their perspective on the law in general, I mean, why wouldn't they pay attention to that? So I would think so. The way in which they collected the tithe, that I don't know. That's a good question. What maybe somebody here can help us with that. And that maybe somebody can help us with the second question. I'm not sure where our practice of actually passing the offering plate comes from. But notice that throughout church history, churches find a way to use social pressure to get you to obey God, not just with respect to your giving, but in all kinds of ways, but especially with respect to your giving, because how can you argue with the results? You know, if you pass the offering plate and you end up over the long haul taking in more money than you would if you just depended upon people to remember and want to do it, then we'll pass their offering plate. Because in the end, the bottom line is about getting the money.
Right, and in some ways, I mean, that's sort of what, a little bit what motivated my tithing question, because you hear even hear a lot about that nowadays in modern evangelical church culture, Christian culture, the idea of tithing. I mean, you know, getting 10% of what you make, whatever, I don't know if it's 10% of your gross or 10% of your net or whatever, whatever's more probably, but where does that, I mean, obviously, when I'm saying where does that come from, it's coming from the same kind of motivation that you were just talking about, I think, but, I mean, is there any weight to that argument at all? I mean...
Well, yes and no, I think. I mean, on the one hand, if you emphasize it so much in terms of tithing, then you're taking an aspect of a covenant that God made with his people that is especially and uniquely about their distinctive relationship with God. Does that have any relevance to us as Gentiles? I would say not directly. Now, indirectly, though, it has relevance to us. On the one hand, there may be some things we can learn from the institution of the tithe that we should pay attention to. And certainly one of those, and this is the most important thing, certainly one of those is the tithe represents, I think, the fact that you wouldn't even have existence if God didn't give you existence. You wouldn't have a nickel if God didn't give you a nickel. And so I think the tithe simply represents my grateful acknowledgement and my recognition that what I have came from God to start with. It ultimately belongs to him, not to me. And therefore, because it belongs to God and I'm only a steward, this is right out of Jesus' teaching, and I'm only a steward of what doesn't belong to me but what belongs to God, then it is incumbent upon me to use my resources, my material resources, to serve the purposes of the owner of those resources, to serve the purposes of God. Now, what does that mean in terms of, you know, the problem, of course, is the highly structured covenant that God made with Israel has the worship of God and the service of God centered in the temple or the tabernacle or, you know, the priesthood. So the tithes went to the upkeep of that. What we Gentile Christians have done is put the church in that place and said, so your tithes need to come to me so that I can do church if I'm a pastor in a church. I think that's wrong. The covenant and what God was doing as Israel was one thing. What we're doing as a church is an entirely different thing. It's not even analogous to that, and it didn't replace that. It's an entirely different thing. We are a community of believers, fellow followers of Jesus, coming together to learn together, to seek the truth together, to pursue the truth together. And the economics of that needs to match what it is we are and what it is we're doing. Now, is what we're doing supportable? You know, is it the kind of thing that is in keeping with what God, with God's purposes and what he wants to accomplish in the world? That is, am I using God's money to support what God is doing and wanting to do and is in favor of happening in the world when I give to the church? I think it depends on the church. I think the support for some churches is diabolically wrong. The support for other churches is perfectly appropriate. But even the support you give to a church where it's diabolically wrong, just like the widow, if you're doing it to serve God, God doesn't care that it's diabolically wrong. I mean, he's going to see it as love of him for what it is inwardly, not for what impact it has or what consequences or what effect it has in the world. Our biggest problem, it seems to me, let me speak for myself. My biggest problem is that I'm a self-protective, greedy brat. And, you know, tithing would be great. It wouldn't really, because it wouldn't really solve the problem, but I give way too little. That my problem is not that, I don't know. I mean, it would be so easy to attack the institution of tithing on the grounds that I'd rather be greedy. And the important thing is that we, as much as it is true that tithing is not directly relevant to me as a Gentile, nonetheless, I really need to take to heart. But how important is it for me to learn to be, A, generous, because my Father in heaven is generous, to be like him in being open-handed with all that I have. And then secondly, to know that the money doesn't really belong to me. I don't really have the ultimate say on what I should be doing with this. It should go to the service of God.
That's really good. That is really, really good and very, very convicting and compelling. So that makes a lot of sense. Okay. Thank you very much, Jack.
Thanks.
And I'll just tack onto that in some liturgical practices, that's the spirit of the offering going around, is recognizing that this is what God has given us and we are giving it back to him in some way. And I think it can be a really beautiful practice as well. I mean, I came up in the kind of schmaltzy, squeeze it out of everybody kind of culture that I just can't abide. But having observed the more liturgical side of things in some churches, I think it can be a really lovely reminder of just what you're saying, that all things come of thee and of thee, and to thee, O God, we give these things, or something like that. I'm not a very good Episcopal, but that's the spirit of it. And it can be really lovely.
Thanks, Jack. That was great. The one, I've done a lot of thinking on that topic too, and it's what you said really matches what I've come to a T, and that, yeah, why is our giving all go to the church? The only other distinction I like to make is I just get away from using the word tithe, and for us Gentiles, it's giving that's important. Tithing was something that the Jews were obligated to do, mm-hmm. but we're compelled and instructed to be cheerful givers, mm-hmm. to be generous, as you said. My question had to do with the widow's offering and your insight that it's the inwardness. Ultimately, when it's all said and done, as you alluded to earlier, that it's an individual thing, it's not a group thing, that it's comes down to me and God and who was I really on the inside, and that he's pointing out that the widow has it right. You know, it's her inwardness that's important, and we so easily overlook that. I think that it's somehow built into man's DNA to want to achieve in this life, to do something great, to make a name for himself, to leave his mark on history. And yet it seems that God is saying that that's not the important thing in life. The important thing in life is to get it right on the inside with me. And that contrast is, it's so easy to forget that in the light of all of the things that I want to do with my life and own property to pass on to my children and even do something greater and all these sorts of things. And I guess, so the in a previous church existence prior to coming here, the emphasis seemed to always be that yes, you were going to do something great for God, that was a big deal, you know, and whether that could mean a lot of things to different people, I guess, having a big church but it always somehow had to do with having some ministry. And the emphasis got put on, I guess this is my story, is I always wanted to do some big thing for God. And that big thing had to do with winning souls in the vernacular. And so it wasn't about having tons of money or anything like that, but this big, there was a lot of pat yourself on the back because you did such a good job at your ministry or whatever, and you made a mark on history. Like Billy Graham was the super idol to aspire to, right? I mean, he had this big thing. And so I want to get your take on, because that always came back to the Great Commission, that Jesus said, go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. And I guess I'd like to get your input on your take on that scripture, for one. And is there an importance in our life of being an influence on others to serve God, to evangelize at all, to just let our light shine before men so that all, you know, it seems like there's a handful of scriptures that encourage us, not just to be inward God followers, but to be kind of influences in mm-hmm. our society, to point to him. I think you're picking up where I'm going, and I'd just really like to hear what you think our duty, if you will, is as a Christian before God, if it's something more than the inwardness that Jesus gave accolade to in the widow.
I have about 25 thoughts. I'll try to get some of them. First of all, this is sort of tangential to what you're saying, but before I forget it, it is important in stressing inwardness. We need to beware. We need to be on our guard that we not be too shallow in what we understand inwardness to be. Inwardness can easily translate for a lot of people into some kind of psycho-emotional state or experience of some kind. Or inwardness can be really counterfeited. I mean, notice that Jesus is reading the inwardness off of an act by this woman. So inwardness, you know, I can't just sit on the sofa and, you know, listen to the Grateful Dead or something and say my heart is right before God. It doesn't matter what I do in the world. I mean, my inwardness displays the fact that I'm right with God. And just watch me dance. That's not inwardness. Inwardness expresses itself outwardly, but it doesn't have to. My point is, even though it will express itself outwardly, it doesn't have to express itself in changing the world. It doesn't have to express itself dramatically. It is what it is, regardless of the scope and scale of the effects that it has out there in the world. But it won't be invisible and silent in the sense that it won't make itself out into the way we live our lives. So I don't want to be misunderstood there. Inwardness always manifests itself outwardly. Probably the best passage to keep in mind with respect to the main part of your question would be the Corinthians passage. There are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are varieties of ministries, but the same Lord, right? And there's varieties of effects, but it's the same God who works. I may have the wrong people connected to, but the crucial thing is, What I'm called to do is to be faithful to my Lord, to use the gifts that God has given me, to employ the gifts that God has given me, to be faithful to my Lord. It's not up to me to make sure that it has a dramatic effect in the world. That's not even in my hands. The minute I go about trying to guarantee that it has a dramatic effect, I've stopped being faithful. I've started coercing, manipulating, doing what I can to bring about the result that's going to look like a meaningful result. It's not up to me to bring about whatever results happen in the world. So you can have completely, utterly faithful people who pass through history totally unnoticed, completely don't make a mark on history. Is that not the prerogative of God? And I dare say there have probably been thousands of such people throughout church history. Some of the most significant people in the world, we know nothing about them. We don't even know they existed. But in the eyes of God, they were remarkably wise, faithful, godly men and women. So that we really do have a choice to make. The choice that we have to make is, do we want to be faithful and godly and wise, or do we want to make a difference? And it is the tragedy of Christian culture, is that we don't even see the distinction there for the most part. Go out there and make a difference, young man. You better make a difference. God needs you to change the world for him. Really? God needs you. Okay, so it's really important to make that distinction, and then I think ultimately it's really important to make the right choice. Don't go out there to make a difference. Go out there to be faithful. Great Commission. Well, first of all, it was specifically and directly relevant to the 12. That's instructions for them. Kind of related to what I just said. As an individual follower of Jesus, my first and foremost goal is to follow Jesus. That is, what does it mean to follow Jesus? To make him the rabbi and me be the student. He's my rabbi. And what's the significance of having a rabbi? I learn from him. He needs to teach me. Teach me what's true. Teach me what's real. Teach me about God. Teach me about myself. I need to receive the instructions of Jesus, who knows. I need to receive his instruction and have that completely enlighten me in my understanding of life and reality. That's my first and foremost job. Is it my task to go out and make sure that other people become followers of Jesus in the same way? That's going to be dependent partly on calling. Some of us are probably called to that. But even then, again, if you decide you're called to it, what do you do? Don't go out and make disciples. Just be faithful, and disciples will happen. I mean, if that's what you're called to, if that's what God intends to, the role that he intends to give you, then the result is going to be, if God so chooses, that people are going to be persuaded to follow Jesus by your example, your teaching, your instruction, and so on. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the huge mistakes that, and I came out of a church that advanced this notion, you know, decades ago, is that you need to know your gift. No, you don't. You don't need to know what your gift is. Your gift is your gift. It's going to happen. Gifts happen. that the minute we start becoming self-conscious about it, again, the minute we become fake, inauthentic, coercive, manipulative, all the wrong stuff. Just faithfully pursue the truth, obeying God, and being mindful of who you are and what contribution you think you could make, and try it. And then just see what happens. But it's the faithfulness that counts, not the results. One more?
I want to go back to the widow, the question of the widow. You pointed out, I thought it was really interesting, this ironic twist, that the temple's going to be destroyed 40 years from now. They're all giving money toward this thing that's going to go down. And when you think about it, so much of our giving is about that. And so then I was thinking about the woman who broke the expensive perfume and put it on Jesus' feet, and they were getting down on her for that. The disciples were, or was it the scribes or Pharisees, or all of them, I'm not sure. And he says, well, she's, you know, this is something important she's done for now, because you'll always have me with you. And I think they were worried that the money could have been used better. It could have been used to feed the poor. I'm trying to remember some of the things specifically, things that sound like good things to do. So, because I'm wanting to think, okay, well, so money is better given to people, individuals, rather than institutions. So God doesn't, I mean, kind of what you seem to be pointing out here in a way is that it's not the money that's important as much as is the heart, which you made really clear. But I'm wondering if you could somehow make a comment on kind of the futility of giving to things, even if you're doing it with the right heart, that ends up being gone anyway, that's not eternal. So many organizations, projects, whatever, they're not eternal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's right. But you need to keep that in perspective. None of what we pursue in this life is eternal. So the fact that it's not eternal doesn't mean it's invalid to do it or accomplish it or set it up or support it or whatever. That in and of itself does not invalidate that kind of support. It's just that we have to have the right perspective. And that is that when I do support it, what is significant about my support and why is it significant? Not because I'm going to make this institution last forever and I'm going to be a part of what this institution is and its success, but rather because I intend to serve God in this way. That's why it's significant. But with respect to everything we do, for that matter, my life is given over to teaching the Bible. There's a lot of futility to that. I mean, when we get to eternity, all of us are going to know it all anyway. Why don't I just wait till then? You know, why bother with us here and now? Well, everything we do has that cast of futility about it. That's just the world we live in, is we live in a world that's not permanent. But nevertheless, God created us as human beings to be productive, to be creative, to be energetic, to do things, imitating Him, imitating His creativity. We're made in the image of God. So it's perfectly valid to do that, even at the same time that I know that it's ultimately futile. It's important, therefore, not to put any hope in the things that we accomplish here. It's not what gives my life meaning. It's not what really defines me as an individual. But because it doesn't define me as an individual, I can pursue it freely. I've probably mentioned this before, but one of my favorite movies and one of the favorite scenes in a movie was Chariots of Fire. And I'll just go quickly because we're running out of time. But remember, there's two runners. Eric Little, who's a Scottish Presbyterian, and Harold Abrahamson, who's a Jew. And they're both running for England back in the early part of the 20th century, going to the Olympics. Lo and behold, they schedule the event that actually both of them were going to run the 100 meters, I think. And they schedule that event on Sunday, which is for a Scottish Presbyterian the Sabbath day. Eric Little is faced with this incredible dilemma. He's been working for years to this day, and and they've scheduled it in such a way that he's going to have to disobey his God in order to even compete. And he decides, I can't do that, much to the consternation of the committee of the Olympic Committee of Britain. He says, I can't do that. I would be disobedient to God if I did that. Never mind that you and I may not agree with his conception of the Sabbath and its implications, but in his conviction, he would be disobeying God. So he's willing to walk away from a potential gold medal altogether because he can't disobey his God to get it. Harold Abrahamson, it's not his Sabbath, and I don't think it would have mattered to him anyway, but he runs. He gets a gold medal. Eric Little gets put in a different event on a different day, and he gets a gold medal in that event. Eric Little experiences his gold medal as a really celebratory moment. He thoroughly enjoys the fact, as it's portrayed in the movie, he thoroughly enjoys the fact that he got the medal. For Harold Abrahamson, it's a moment of utter and complete despair. Why? Because this is everything, his whole life and existence has been aimed at defining the meaning for his life by this gold medal. He got it, now what's left? Now what is there? And he goes out and gets drunk because he's in complete despair over having finished. And obviously, as we know, after the initial thrill, how insignificant every thrilling moment is a few hours later or a few days later. Kierkegaard makes this point. If you're not trying to find meaning in this existence, then you're free to enjoy it. It's when you don't need this life to give your life meaning that you can let it be what it is, joy, delight, celebration, and so on. What a wonderful thing that I got a gold medal. But when you have to find your meaning in this life and this existence, then it's an incredible burden because this world can't do it. I was made for something bigger. I was made for something better. I was made for something more significant than anything this world can offer. And we end up despairing in this life if we try to wring meaning out of this life because it can't happen. Why am I saying all that?
Well, maybe because there's a connection between trying to find meaning in your giving with something that's substantial and long-term.
Yes. Yeah. So we not with respect to giving, but with respect to all of life, I have to have the perspective that everything in this lifetime is futile. That's true. But because once I get the perspective that it's all futile, now I can enjoy it. I actually am freed up to let it be what it is, and the gifts to be gifts, and the blessings to be blessings, and the delights to be delights, because it doesn't have to be anything more than that. It doesn't have to be the meaning of my existence. I got to let you go. Thanks,
Jack.